Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, in for Craig Cohen. Our guest, Akhil Reed Amar, put out books about the Bill of Rights in 1998 and the Constitution in 2006. And last year, he put out a book about the larger context that the Constitution exists in. Professor Amar is Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, and his book, America's Unwritten Constitution, has received some extremely favorable reviews and some of the other kind. Professor Reed joins us from the Yale campus at New Haven, Connecticut. Welcome to Focus, Professor.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
I'm sorry, I keep on calling you Professor Reed, but of course it is Professor Amar.
Thanks.
Well, let's start with the short version of the theme of your book. The United States has a constitution. It's well regarded. Why would there be an unwritten constitution?
Because without an unwritten constitution vindicating the text, we can't fully make sense of the text and really faithfully enforce it. The text, for example, which has only 8,000 words in it, it's designed so that ordinary people can read it. And if it had to specify everything, it would become very long and it wouldn't be a document of the people and for the people, accessible to them. So there's a reason that it's short, but that means it doesn't say separation of powers, doesn't say checks and balances, doesn't say federalism, limited government, the rule of law. Yet all of those things are obviously part of an unwritten constitution that completes the written. Let's take some other examples, maybe now a little bit more edgy. It has amendments, but they're not called a Bill of Rights. State constitutions have sections called a Bill of Rights. When we look at these amendments, the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging free speech. Well, what if the president abridges free speech? What if federal courts abridge free speech? What if before the Civil War, states tried to abridge free speech, as indeed they did? And by the way, before the First Amendment came along, did that mean that the first Congress was free to abridge free speech? I say no. I say free speech is part of the basic structure and context of the original Constitution, even though those words don't appear in so many words. Neither, by the way, do the words one person, one vote. The idea that separate is inherently unequal when it comes to racial segregation. The Constitution, in fact, doesn't even say that a criminal defendant has a right to take the stand in his own defense. And indeed, at the founding, no criminal defendant in America, in any court, state or federal, was allowed to take the stand on his own behalf. Today, that's sort of easy and obvious, and that's a 9-0 proposition on the Supreme Court. Every justice would accept that, but it's not actually in the text, and in fact, it wasn't the practice at the founding or even when Abe Lincoln was president.
Well, we're already raising some questions here, and I want to welcome our listeners to raise their questions as well. And listeners, you're welcome to call in at 333-9455, area code 217 for local calls, or call toll-free at 800-222-9455, or you can send a question in by email to will-talk@illinois.edu. Also welcome your questions on WYLL's Facebook page. You can find us on Facebook at WYLL Radio TV Online, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 217-333-9455. Are 800-222-9455. Now, Professor Amar, going back to the theme of your book, it sounds like things had to be sort of worked out in the Constitution that weren't already written in, and it didn't happen right away in a lot of these things. Certainly with, for instance, dropping the doctrine of separate but equal was something that Supreme Court justices did not figure out right away.
So here's what the spine of the book. Here's the tricky thing. We obviously I at least, and I think most of my fellow citizens, cherish the written Constitution. We don't want to lose any of its virtues. I don't want to allow courts or anyone else in government to ignore all of the safeguards that the written Constitution provides. So we have to figure out how it's ever possible to go beneath and behind and beyond the words while being faithful to the words themselves. The words, for example, themselves in the Ninth Amendment say that not all the rights are specified or textualized. There may be unenumerated rights. The 14th Amendment speaks of privileges and immunities that no state shall abridge, but it doesn't quite itemize and specify what all those privileges and immunities are. So what this book tries to do is show you a series of tools and techniques by which we can supplement but never supplant the written Constitution and ultimately fulfill it. So one technique involves looking at cases like Brown versus Board of Education. Another technique involves reading the Constitution as a whole rather than word by word, clause by clause. That's what gives us things like federalism, limited government, the rule of law, checks and balances, separation of powers. Other techniques involve looking at actual government practices, how the Constitution has in fact been implemented on the ground in ways that fill in some of its gaps and clarify some of its ambiguities. Another technique is to look at how ordinary people actually live their lives in America and thereby embody new unenumerated individual rights. So there are a variety of tools and techniques that the book tries to highlight, and you picked a couple of them actually with your example of Brown versus Board of Education. One technique is to look at case law, and that's actually a very important. The Constitution, and so you say, well, why are we allowed to do that? The Constitution itself talks about judicial power. So its words themselves gesture toward the judiciary, which in turn is purporting not to make stuff up, but to interpret the document. And Brown is one of the important cases interpreting the document. I have a chapter on the Warren Court and how large it looms in our life today, how the Constitution in 1953, before Earl Warren came along, was vastly different than the regime that we have now, and how, in fact, even conservatives have largely accepted basic Warren Court teachings like Brown versus Board of Education. They sometimes have different interpretations of those teachings, but they largely accept the Warren Court. So there's a chapter on that. There's a chapter on how to think about when the precedent seems at odds with the text. That's what Brown had to deal with, because Plessy said separate could be okay, but the text really says equal, and separate really wasn't equal, so what was Brown supposed to do? So there's a chapter on precedent generally, a chapter on the Warren Court, and there's also a chapter on great American icons and symbols that we all have in common, and Brown versus Board of Education is actually an important national symbol. It's not the only one. We could talk about the Declaration of Independence. We could talk about Abe Lincoln. Today would be a great day to talk about Abe Lincoln, given the Academy Award nominations just out. So, and you can't think about the idea of racial equality without thinking about Lincoln and Brown and these icons alongside technical rules about judicial precedent.
I'm wondering, we're talking about this, and you've written your book here in the early 21st century. Was this idea that you had to use these tools to make the Constitution work an idea that people had in the late 18th century when the Constitution was being argued over and enacted?
Indeed, they did, because, of course, just think about the following. The Constitution doesn't quite tell us what the rules of interpretation are. Those themselves are part of, as it were, the unwritten Constitution, the most important part. How do we go about interpreting it? And someone might say, well, Amar, obviously, through the rules of ordinary English. That's it. And so chapter one begins by saying, okay, if that's so, let's take that seriously for just a second. My friend, I would tell this person, who presides at the vice president's impeachment trial? Because when we look at the text, here's what it says. The Senate tries all impeachments, and it also says that the vice president presides over the Senate. So under the rules of standard English, the vice president would preside at his own impeachment trial. And my friend, that can't be right. And the framers didn't believe that was so. But you can't deduce that proper result, that no man can be a judge in his own case, by finding in the literal words, clause by clause, of the Constitution. But you can find it by looking, for example, at a man named Blackstone, who wrote a very famous treatise on Anglo-American law in the 1760s and 70s. It was the single best-selling book in the colonies and early America, except for the Bible. So hundreds of thousands of people read it, ordinary farmers, to learn some basic tools and techniques, the basic ideas of Anglo-American law. And Blackstone has a whole section on how laws have to be understood not just literally, but faithfully, and he identifies a legal doctrine that was in place even before the Constitution was adopted, called the absurdity doctrine. And the absurdity doctrine is if the literal words of the law actually, are preposterous, and they in a situation where you have a very good reason to think that the framers weren't quite thinking about this really weird, quirky situation, then you actually have to figure out the deep purpose of the law rather than its literal words. And here he gives two examples. One, he says, if a law says that the lord of the manor dale gets to try all cases in the manor dale, fine. But of course, that doesn't apply when he himself is a party to the case, because of course, no man can be a judge in his own case, which is, of course, relevant to the vice presidency. He gives another example. A law in Bologna says it's a felony, it's a capital offense to spill blood, to shed blood in the streets of Bologna. But what happens if a surgeon performs an emergency operation for a stricken pedestrian? Obviously, the words of that statute might arguably apply, but it would be absurd to hang the surgeon for trying to save a life. So before the Constitution was even adopted, the framers of the Constitution understood that there were background principles and precepts against which, unwritten, against which we have to construe the written text. And then they added a Ninth Amendment saying, in effect, we understand that not all the rights that we've specified, that those aren't the only rights. You can't take away from any of the rights that we have put in the text. So we don't believe in an unwritten constitution that subtracts rights, but we do think there might be an unwritten constitution that permits the adding of rights.
I'm Jim Meadows, and my guest on Focus this morning is Akhil Reed Amar, professor of law and political science at Yale University and author of America's Unwritten Constitution, published by Basic Books. Welcome your thoughts this morning at 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor Amar, I was wondering, was that argued as such? If you looked at a document like the Federalist Papers or any of the debates over the Constitution, or even in some of the early court cases on the Constitution, were people saying this? Is that not every case is going to be in the language of this document? We just have to look at other sources, some of them self-evident, to make it work.
Absolutely. And by the way, note what you just did. And you did absolutely right, and it's brilliant, but you didn't even quite think about it. You mentioned the Federalist Papers. Now, that's part of the unwritten Constitution. Yes, it's written down, so are cases, but they're not part of the 8,000 words that we call the Constitution. But obviously, you'd want to look at the Federalist Papers. And so when I talked about these great icons and symbols above and beyond the written Constitution that have special constitutional status, I mentioned Brown versus Board of Education and the Declaration of Independence, and Lincoln, but I also mentioned the Federalist Papers. And from an early date, the Supreme Court itself, the Marshall Court, said the Federalist Papers are entitled to special status in interpreting the document. And Marshall also said in perhaps one of the three most famous cases ever decided, Brown probably is one, Marbury is one, but the other is McCulloch versus Maryland. And in that great case, John Marshall, writing for a unanimous Supreme Court, actually says explicitly, not everything in the Constitution is written down in so many words. There are implicit principles of the Constitution. It doesn't say in so many words that the federal government has the power to create a national bank. Marshall said, well, yes, of course there is power to create a national bank, but it's not in any particular clause. It's in the document as a whole, read with attention to its basic purposes, and with a recognition that certain things, powers, certain other things, rights, are actually implied as well as expressed. And he says that very clearly in the great case of McCulloch versus Maryland.
So you're in effect saying is that whether or not people understand or that they do this, that they interpret the Constitution in these ways. That's how it gets done. That's how the Constitution's been used for a couple of centuries.
And here's another thing that Marshall says, which connects to our conversation. He says, here's one additional argument for a bank, that the first Congress proposes a bank and that George Washington signs it into law. So apparently, according to Marshall, the things that George Washington did are of special significance in interpreting the Constitution in a case of ambiguity. And he's right about that. And I have a whole chapter, in fact, on the precedents set, the first precedents set by our first president. And on issue after issue after issue, especially about executive power, what does the work today in court and on the ground isn't what the text says about executive power, but what George Washington actually did about executive power. So right now, for example, within the last couple of months, Barack Obama has decided to recognize the Syrian rebels, as he earlier recognized the Libyan rebels. But there's no explicit text in Article 2 that says that. But George Washington did that when he decided to recognize the French revolutionaries. Barack Obama right now is going to be replacing some cabinet officers. Cabinet officers serve at the president's pleasure. He can fire them on any day. When he came into office, he told Hank Paulson, Secretary of the Treasury, to go because he wanted Geithner. But he didn't tell Ben Bernanke, the head of the Fed, to go. And we all understood he can tell Paulson to go because that's a Bush cabinet officer, but he can't tell Bernanke to go. But where does the text say anything like that? It doesn't. But under George Washington, certain precedents were established. The presidents could fire cabinet officers at will, but not everyone in the government was subject to those firing at will rules. So on issue after issue, presidents today ask themselves, not what does the text say, but in effect, what would George Washington do? What did George Washington do? In the same way that Christians might ask themselves, not just what does the Bible say, but what did Jesus do? What did Washington do? That's an important part of the Christian tradition. It's an important part of the American constitutional tradition. What did George do?
And George Washington has a special role then as the first president, and also one of the people who pushed for the Constitution so that we would look at him in
yes.
a different way than, say, looking at what John Adams did?
Exactly. I think Washington has a special status above and beyond Adams, and the text doesn't say that, but that's actually our practice. And that's, I believe, not that controversial. That's what people unselfconsciously do, whether they're conservative justices or liberal justices.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we welcome your questions and comments for Akhil Reed Amar, professor of law and political science at Yale University and author of America's Unwritten Constitution, The Precedents and Principles We Live By. If you have questions about how the Constitution works or ought to work or the way it's working but shouldn't be, we'd like to hear them. Call in at 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number is again 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And Professor Amar, do other governing documents work that way? Was, for instance, I don't know, the Articles of Confederation before the Constitution regarded and used as in the same way that the Constitution is used?
Well, the Articles didn't even describe themselves as law, much less the supreme law of the land trumping everything in a state constitution. Judges didn't take oaths to the Articles of Confederation, but judges in the state courts did take oaths to their state constitutions. And I have a chapter on the importance of state constitutions alongside the federal constitution. There are a family of American constitutions, really 51 of them, and they all have all sorts of very interesting things in common. And one important feature of what I'm calling the unwritten Constitution, is the way in which it draws strength from, it reflects, and sometimes slightly deviates from the state constitutional background. So here are some things that all our constitutions, state and federal, have in common. Written constitutions in everywhere. That's not true of Israel, for example. It's not true of Britain. Three branches of government, very separate, with a separate, for example, executive branch. That's not true in England, where the legislature picks a prime minister. A bicameral legislature, except in Nebraska. That's not really true in England anymore, or in Israel or other places. Judges who enforce the written constitution, state and federal, against contrary laws, a practice called judicial review. That's true of every court in America, not just one supreme constitutional court. Juries everywhere, two parties, single member districts for legislators in most jurisdictions, governors who look a lot like presidents, 4-year terms in 48 of the states, veto pens, pardon pens, elected independently of the legislature, having a kind of an executive understudy, a lieutenant governor who looks a lot like a vice president. So there's some fascinating similarities between the state and federal constitutional systems that I try to highlight.
I have a couple of phone calls coming in, and I want to go to John in Urbana on line one. John in Urbana, you're on the air on Focus.
The question that I have is, why have we been losing our liberty by observing laws in foreign countries?
Thank you very much, caller. Let's take up that. Are we observing laws in foreign countries, Professor Amar? And is there any thought on what the Constitution says about that?
Well, I don't really think we are, as a general proposition.
I'm sure there's a body of people who believe that there is that danger.
Well, I can't prove the negative, so I need to hear an example of where Sharia law or something like that has actually been imposed on America. This seems actually just bluntly not true to me. Now, let me give you one qualification. In various cases, the Supreme Court, Justice Kennedy, for example, appointed by Ronald Reagan in particular, has mentioned foreign practices in the course of trying to figure out what the American Constitution might sensibly mean. So, in a death penalty case, he said, "Today we decide that putting to death someone who was a juvenile when he committed the crime, he or she, is cruel and unusual. The main basis for that decision is that there was a time when putting juvenile offenders to death was very common in America. It no longer is. It has become unusual now in a way that it wasn't before." And he proves that by counting up state practices. That's the main bulk of the opinion. He drops one footnote to say it's also worth mentioning that almost no one else in the civilized world puts juveniles to death. Our other great Western democracies that have civilized values similar to the United States don't do this. So that's one footnote. It's not binding in any way. It's no different than his citing a Law Review article, and he's been nice enough to cite mine and other people's. And that's not because my Law Review articles are legally authoritative, but just because he finds that they may have some interesting and useful information that helps inform his and his colleagues' ultimate judgment on what the words cruel and unusual sensibly mean in America in the 21st century.
It's time for a short break. We do have one call waiting, and we'll get to that call in just a moment. This is Focus.
Barry Lopez is best known for writing about the natural world, but he goes deep into his own inner life in an essay about how he was abused by a pedophile over a period of 4 years and how that affected the course of his life. Lopez's essay about confronting the trauma of sexual abuse is in the January edition of Harper's. We'll talk with him on the next Fresh Air.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Alto Vineyards, offering a retail wine shop and tasting room featuring Illinois wines from their own vineyard, 1 mile north of Illinois 150 Bloomington Road on North Duncan Road. More information is available at 356-4784.
I'm Jim Meadows, and today for Craig Cohen, we're back on Focus on WILL and taking your questions and comments about the Constitution and the unwritten Constitution that makes it work, according to Yale University professor Raquel Reed Amar. He's the author of books on the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and most recently, America's Unwritten Constitution, published by Basic Books. And let's go ahead to a call we have for Tony in Urbana, talking about the Constitution and other documents. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is a great opportunity for me to check my facts. I understand one of the first bodies of law was the Code of Hammurabi, and it was explicit in that code, I understand, that the first objective, to paraphrase, was to protect the weak and the powerless. Now, I don't really know if that's correct or not. I imagine your guest does. But I was curious, if you looked at our Constitution, would you say that it's also unwritten that the first order of business is to protect the privileged classes, the landed and wealthy?
Thanks, Tony, for that question. So the first word of the title of this book is America's. This is a book about America's Constitution. This connects to the previous question. So my analysis is really about the American system. I tell you a lot more about state constitutions, for example, than foreign constitutions. And the reason I do is that foreign constitutions are often very different from ours, whereas all 50 of the state constitutions look a lot like the federal constitution. So, Tony, this is all by way of confessing I don't know that much about Hammurabi, but here's what I can tell you the purposes of our Constitution are. We, the people of the United States, and they're going to tell you the purposes. Law doesn't always do it. It usually tells you to do it, but doesn't tell you why. But the Constitution begins by telling you why. We, the people of the United States, in order to, and then here are the purposes, form a more perfect union, establish justice, which seems to me to be about fairness to the little guy as well as the fat cat, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Those are the purposes. That's why we, the people of the United States, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. So the truth is, our Constitution is designed by Americans for Americans with these great purposes. I read these great purposes as being about fairness to small fry as well as fat cats. You also asked, Tony, about how the Constitution was actually adopted, and I have a chapter on that, because even though the process by which the Constitution is adopted isn't in the specific words of the document, it's of course part of the Constitution, how the thing actually came into existence, what we actually did when we, the people, did ordain and establish this thing. A Constitution is a deed, a doing, and here's what I say, that more people were allowed to participate 225 years ago in how the Constitution and whether the Constitution was to be ratified than had ever been allowed to participate in anything before in human history. Property qualifications in 8 of the 13 states were lowered or eliminated. In some places, for example, New York, all adult free male citizens were allowed to vote. No religious tests, no property tests, no race tests. It was epic. And not just that, amazing free speech for a whole year up and down a continent. Some people were for the thing, some people were against it. Robust, uninhibited, wide open, raucous, pointy-elbowed, rude at times speech, but no one dies. In a whole year, unlike the French Revolution or what's happening in Syria today or the American Revolution for that matter. So I say broad political participation and free speech are baked into the constitutional cake even before the Bill of Rights, even before the First Amendment says we the people have free speech. We actually exercise free speech in the course of doing the thing. The Constitution, as it were, was crowdsourced. It came from Philadelphia Convention, a proposal drafted by a tiny group of people in secret. And then it went up and down a continent for a year, and they crowdsourced it, Wikipedia-like, and they basically said, Dudes, you forgot something, you forgot the rights. That's what gives us the Bill of Rights. The phrase that appears in 5 of the first 10 amendments, more than any other phrase, is the words, the people. It's in the 1st, the 2nd, the 4th, the 9th, and the 10th amendments. And that's because the Bill of Rights actually came from the people, from this epically democratic event. Now, from our perspective, of course, it was limited. What about women? What about slaves? There were some property qualifications. But from the perspective of 1786, it was more democratic than anything the world had ever seen, and by a wide margin. And over the 225 years since, it's only become more democratic. Getting rid of slavery, equal rights for blacks, woman suffrage, getting rid of poll taxes, 18-year-old vote in our lifetime. Epic.
Well, I'm not really that convinced that it was quite as epic as you delineate. I mean, I understand that, for example, that pirate ships were quite egalitarian as to their administration, their management, and leadership, and I think there were American Indians were quite good about that too. But as you say, those are foreign concepts. So, thank you.
Thank you, caller. And I guess you're saying that, I guess the question comes down to right now, as the court is working with the Constitution, do they still live up to those goals of the preamble of the Constitution? Do you think that's continued across the years, not just in the founders?
Yeah. Well, that's the question for my fellow citizens. On pirate ships and Indians, just to pick up on Tony's last point, first of all, pirates plunder other people. And I do want you to just see the scope, the breadth of the thing. There was democracy in the world in a very few tiny little places for 2,000 years before the American Constitution. But these were in little Greek city-states where people spoke the same language, worshiped the same religions, little gangs and clubs. And they had slavery too, by the way. But we're talking the American Constitution up and down a whole continent, 3 million people, different faiths, different languages, in an epic conversation that really does change the world. And has the Supreme Court been faithful to that vision over time? Not always. Dred Scott is a great example, and I think, of course, of Dred Scott because it played such a role in your state, in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Abe Lincoln gets re-energized because of pro-slavery things that are being done in part in the courts and elsewhere, and that sort of re-energizes him, and he gets back into politics basically to contest Roger Taney's perverse vision of the Constitution that promoted slavery in ways that went far beyond anything that was really a faithful interpretation of the document as a whole. When Earl Warren takes office in 1953, I don't think we're fully living up to the Constitution. Here's the world in 1953. Apartheid in major parts of the country, Jim Crow, segregation that's really not equal, massive malapportionment of many state legislatures and malapportionment of most state legislatures. The Bill of Rights generally doesn't apply against the states in court, even though it was designed to do so. Organized prayers being composed by governments done in the public schools in ways that disadvantaged Catholics and other religious minorities. Very few rights of criminal defendants. No constitutional right to vote that was sort of robustly protected. And not broad protections of freedom of speech in court, even though the document says free speech. That was 1953. The courts between, let's say, 1870 and 1950 especially between 1870 and 1935, did not do a very good job, in my personal view, of really living up to the best ideals of the document. And the Warren Court changed a lot, and conservatives initially attacked it, but conservatives today basically buy into five of the six big things that the Warren Court did. They believe, conservatives today now, believe in Brown versus Board of Education. They say, well, we don't like affirmative action, the Constitution should be colorblind, but that's because Brown stated a right principle. We should all be equal. They believe in applying the Bill of Rights against the states. They say, but that's true of the Second Amendment, gun rights, as well as the First and the Fourth and other things. So in fact, I think today we have more of a consensus about some of the things that the Warren Court did that were right, that actually brought our practices into greater alignment with the great purposes of the document.
Okay, and we have some very patient callers waiting for us, and I'm starting with line three and Eric in Urbana, who had his call dropped, but he's called back. Eric, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. My question is, can the federal government be sued? To be specific, Soldier Bradley Manning has been in jail almost 3 years now, and it seems to me that if they can put a person in jail, a citizen in jail, before trial for that length of time, if they can do that to him, they can do that to anybody, and that isn't right. And I don't feel that because he's a soldier that changes his rights as a citizen.
That's a great question, and I do have some discussion in my book about the relationship of the military to our larger constitutional system. I talk, for example, about where we get the idea of a draft. And it turns out that it's not so obvious from the words of the Constitution alone that a draft is permissible, but Abe Lincoln did it during the Civil War, and that's part of our unwritten Constitution. Now, why is that relevant to Bradley Manning? Because although we don't have a draft anymore today, once you sign up for the military, and we don't have a draft, but once you sign up, actually, your status is very different than my deciding to work for Yale University. If I walk away from Yale, they can't actually force me to complete my contract. They could sue me for damages, but they can't grab me. That's not true if you sign up for the military. So our military is governed by different rules than govern the civilians. And I don't know enough about all the details of the Bradley Manning detention, but I do try to talk in the book about the different rules that apply to the military and the way in which sort of issues of military justice sort of fit into the constitutional system.
And can you tell me where the Equal Protection Clause is in the Constitution? I looked for it. I couldn't find it. I know it's in the Supreme Court building.
But it's in the 14th Amendment, Section 1, the second sentence.
All right, thank you.
Now, in addition to the second sentence, the very first sentence of the 14th Amendment, I believe, is also an equality-like clause. It's the clause that says everyone born in the United States is a citizen of the United States. And I think what that means is they're born not just a citizen, but an equal citizen. It's the textualization of the great declaration principle that they're all born equal, we're all created equal. So Abe Lincoln believes that. He says that in the Gettysburg Address. He reads the Declaration a certain way. He's part of our iconic symbolic Constitution, and so is the Gettysburg Address, and so is the Declaration of Independence. And all of that vision, that equality vision, that we're all born equal, black and white, male and female, Jew or Gentile, whether you're born first in your family or fifth, you should have the same inheritance rights. That idea of birth equality is also in the first sentence of the 14th Amendment.
We're talking with Akhil Amar of Yale University and the author of America's Written Constitution. And did I say written? I'm certainly.
Yes.
I meant unwritten Constitution, although you've written about the other one as well.
Let's
go over to line one, and Eleanor in Champaign has a question about the Constitution and its amendments. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Do you think that our Constitution will need to be amended to deal with goals of globalization, for instance, or the UN government or the environment?
That's a brilliant question. I end the afterword of the book saying that This is a question that I haven't done justice to in this project. I think it's the next question to be asked, and maybe I'm not the right person to fully answer that because I don't know enough about the rest of the world. I know a lot about America, but that's the note on which I end, actually, the book, thinking about how not just whether other constitutions should affect ours, which I got asked earlier, but about how our constitution might be a model for the world in various ways. In 1787, the United States Constitution was nothing less in its time than, in effect, a vision of world government for the new world. You know,
Did people see that? Did people understand that to be the case?
Yes. Exactly. And Benjamin Franklin said just that. And he actually writes a letter saying, you know, if this project works in America, you all in Europe should come up with the United States of Europe. He writes that letter. They absolutely understood that they were trying to create something the likes of which had never been seen before, a continental republic of vast geographic sweep and scope. And as a practical matter, until much later, separated from the old world by the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, we were a kind of world unto ourselves. Also, one other thing, the last chapter of the book, not the afterword, but the last chapter of the book does invite readers to think about one other aspect of the unwritten Constitution, the Constitution still to be written, the Constitution of the future for America, the amendments that we might draft in our generation or shortly thereafter for 2020, 2121, 2222, the Constitution of America of the future. And I have some thoughts about what amendments are likely to pass in the future and why and which ones should and shouldn't.
Let me go over to another caller, a caller on line two, Louise from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a story that may amuse your guest. Some years ago, we were the host family to a young English lawyer who was here taking a master's degree in comparative law, and she was very offended by the fact that some of her classmates kept telling her that the British had no constitution because it wasn't written down. So I think maybe that's the spirit that Europe might approach your very interesting idea of a global constitution with.
I love that question. On the first three pages of my introduction, I talk about the differences between the American Constitution and the British Constitution. And yes, please never tell a Brit that they don't have a constitution.
That's
they
right.
will be very offended. They have one. It just isn't reduced.
He started with Magna Carta and went on from there.
Exactly. It's not reduced to a single text. And many people think, oh, we rejected all of that. We have a written constitution and not an unwritten one. And I say, actually, no, we have both. We have a written constitution. And we also have things like Magna Carta. We call them the Declaration of Independence and the Gettysburg Address and the I Have a Dream speech and the Federalist Papers and the Northwest Ordinance and Brown versus Board of Education. And they are for us what in England would be Magna Carta, Petition of Right, and other sort of iconic elements of the British system that aren't all written down in one place, but really define British sort of culture, practice, tradition, custom, and so on.
How beautifully you put it. I shall have to read your book.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, caller. And let's go over to another caller here on Focus in Chicago, Louise. Louis, excuse me, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I'm of the opinion that if the founders were around today, they wouldn't give us the same constitution. I think that if you look at many of the quotes of the founding fathers, they felt that religion and morality were very important to the working of the constitution. In fact, I think James Madison, after he wrote, he says this will only work with a moral people. And I think if you look at the culture today, I think they just wouldn't give us the same constitution today because it's just not working, and they probably predicted it wouldn't work in these circumstances.
Well, I'm a little less of a pessimist. I do think compared to the rest of the world, ours is working pretty well. I'd rather be here than anywhere else. Now, on religion, I have a lot of discussion of that in the book. And And while religion isn't prominent on the surface of the written Constitution, I highlight six documents that are kind of iconic, and five of those iconic documents have prominent references to religion. One is the Gettysburg Address, and Abe Lincoln says, "This nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom." And another is the Declaration of Independence, which famously talks about nature and nature's God and the supreme governor of the universe, and all men are created by, endowed by their creator with unalienable rights. So the Declaration has religious references, and so does the Gettysburg Address. And so does the Federalist Papers, and so does the Northwest Ordinance that actually has a specific provision about religion, morality, and education being central. And so does the I Have a Dream speech, which, of course, was delivered by someone who wasn't merely a civil rights leader. If you had asked Martin King to describe himself, Martin Luther King, to describe himself, he would not have said civil rights leader first and foremost. He would have said, "I'm a preacher of the gospel. You know, from that everything else flows." And when you can't read that I Have a Dream speech and not see the dozens of biblical allusions, especially to Isaiah, but it's a profuse meditation on morality and religion as part of our system.
Yes, well, I see such a low participation in voting, and especially in certain areas, and I just think that there's so much secularism that and society and the separation of morality and in politics, and I just think that in that type of environment, this Constitution just is not going to work. That's my opinion.
Hmm. One final thing, I strongly believe in. That the Constitution is not anti-religious, and that's a big theme of the book, but it isn't pro-religious either. Quite what it is welcoming of persons of all backgrounds. So it's really interesting, for example, that the Constitution says there's not going to be a religious test for office holding, and it's unusual. In that respect, no state constitution has such a provision. And in fact, 10 of the existing state constitutions have religious tests for office holding. The Constitution doesn't. And two of the four guys up there on Mount Rushmore are not conventional churchgoers when they're elected president, Tom Jefferson and Abe Lincoln. You think about the fact that even though ours remains a dominantly a Protestant nation, none of the current 9 justices of the Supreme Court is Protestant, 6 Catholics, 3 Jews. Of the 4 people running for president and vice president last time around, only Barack Obama was Protestant, with a Muslim father. Joe Biden, Catholic. Paul Ryan, Catholic. Mitt Romney, Protestant, but not mainstream a Protestant. Neither John Boehner nor Mitch McConnell, I believe, is a Protestant. So very interesting, this openness to people of all faith backgrounds. I think it's a great thing about America that we don't have religious tests.
Okay, well, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, caller. And I think I have room for just one more call, depending on how things go. Good morning in Piatone. Jeff, you have a question. You're on the air.
God bless you, son. You know what? I'm glad you're bringing this project, this topic up. I think that America's kids nowadays aren't looking at the Constitution or the religious factor that plays into government anymore. I think that's the big push to get rid of it out of all government, which is sad because it just shows you the topic and the way that our, parents are not parenting. And my question is, I have a personal opinion about this, but do you ever see the Constitution and religion completely wiped out as far as it being in the Constitution? Because I personally do. I think in another couple of years, I think by the year, maybe another 4 or 5 years, I don't think you'll see religion anywhere in the Constitution anymore. Do you? I'll get off.
Well,
thanks, guys.
Thank you, Colin.
I'm hesitant to ever embed religion in the actual laws because that can be used actually against people of faith. You know, if the government composes a prayer, maybe it'll be a Protestant prayer and exclude Catholics, and that actually happened in America. So I think our laws have to be strictly religiously neutral. But that doesn't mean we discriminate against religion. And so I talk about how vouchers are perfectly okay, for example, in one passage. But let me give you just one illustration of a role that religion can play in our public space, but not in our laws. I told you about what George Washington did in his practices. He swears his oath of office on a Bible. Now, he's not required to do so because the oath of office in the written Constitution doesn't require any religious element. And I like the fact that it doesn't, that it's open to everyone. But Washington is allowed, if he chooses, to swear on a Bible. Presidents today can choose, and most have in the recent era, to say the words, "So help me God." The Constitution's written text doesn't require that. But it doesn't prohibit that either. That's a profession of personal faith that people in the public square are allowed to make. And so I don't want to try to stamp out religion from all aspects of our public life, even though I do want to very much champion the idea that our laws, our formal rules, need to be strictly equal and neutral and not privileging some religious folks over other religious folks or non-religious folks.
And that's where we're going to have to leave things. Akhil Reed Amar is the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University and the author of America's Unwritten Constitution, published by Basic Books. Akhil Amar, thanks for joining us this morning.
Been a real pleasure. Thank you, Jim.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. And if you know of anyone who might enjoy hearing Focus who lives outside of our listening area, let them know we stream this program live every day at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen to past programs. Kimberly Cronick is the host for tomorrow's Focus, and the topic will be home birth and midwifery, a topic we've been exploring on reports this week during Morning Edition and the Afternoon Magazine. Kimberly's guests will all be midwives themselves, and they'll be talking about the midwifery model of childbirth and how it's practiced in homes and hospitals. That's on tomorrow's Focus here on WILL AM. Today's program produced by Travis Stanzel and Lindsay Moon. Other members of the Focus team are Pam Dempsey, Kimberly Cronick, and our regular host, Craig Cohen. I'm Jim Meadows.